Hey, Ethan, nice to see you again.
Yeah, absolutely. I love doing the show with you guys, especially since it's my first trekking in the new year.
Yeah, man, it's going to be awesome.
I just have one question for you, though, Ethan.
Okay, shoot.
Ever dance with the devil by the pale moonlight?
What?
I always like to ask that of all our guests. I just like the sound of it.
Mark, why are you being creepy again?
And where is this coming from?
Say, isn't that what the Joker says in Tim Burton's Batman?
Well, thanks for killing the point, guys. Look, I just saw the name of our final episode and was psyched because I could finally use that line somewhere. But you guys killed it.
Sorry, Ridge. Hey, let's go back and try it again.
Yeah, it seemed kind of cool.
And it matched the title, so it's something.
Forget it. Just do the review.
I thought you wanted to make this month's intro themed commercials.
Just roll the intro music.
Oh boy, he's touchy today. Get the knives away from him.
Sci-Fi Malady, symptom 182, in the pale moonlight. Alternate title to this week. It's a fake! I don't do that very well, but that's what everybody knows this one by. It's the one with the meme! We are here to...
Is that a meme?
It is.
Yeah, I'm looking that up now. Yeah.
I have that GIF on hot standby at all times.
Yeah, it's probably one of the more, like, I guess it's probably, at one point, it was probably one of the top 10 or 15 used out there for a while. It was really popular for a minute.
Oh, man, I got to look that up.
But we're wrapping up, trekking into the new year 2021. My favorite episodes of Deep Space Nine. That doesn't mean they're the best, but that means that in my opinion, these are the best, most essential episodes of Deep Space Nine. We're joined by Ethan, and Ethan at some point today is going to give us the episodes that he thinks should have been in consideration or maybe should have been in here above mine. Today, we get to In the Pale Moonlight, which is not only my favorite episode of Deep Space Nine, but I'm just going to say it. It is my favorite episode of Star Trek in the entire franchise.
The entire franchise?
The entire franchise. And that's something coming from the guy who really loves the Roddenberry vision and the positive vision of the future. But yeah, I don't think that it gets better than this episode in the entire franchise.
Okay.
On the short list of that, you'd have to look at the best episodes of every series, and people would throw out The Inner Light, Best of Both Worlds.
I'm just going to say
this right
now.
City on the Edge of Forever.
Inner Light is overrated. I've always said that.
Picard learns to play the flute.
Yeah, and we get to revisit it with him later in the series. Great. But, no, and I'm not saying that you're saying In the Pale Moonlight is one of the greatest episodes of Trek is a bad take. I don't think that at all. I don't know. You seem like the kind of guy that does gravitate more toward the Next Generation original TOS. Like you said, that positive Roddenberry point of view. And it's interesting that you would light on this one as perhaps your favorite.
Well, he did. He used to definitely more go that direction, I think.
Yeah, it's just surprising me to hear that.
I think, we're going to get into a lot of why I think that today, but there's so much to this episode, and in the end, you're not fully betraying the Roddenberry vision. You're just looking at the unseen other side of the Roddenberry vision when it comes to this. And look, if you play back the Corbinite maneuver, you're going to hear me sound like I'm contradicting myself, because what I love about the Corbinite maneuver is when the ship is about to be destroyed and everyone's about to die, Captain Kirk basically says, we're still going to be who we are. And then when they think that they've escaped, they go save Balak, because we say that this is who we are and we cling to these principles. And they go ahead and they save Balak anyway, even though he may try to kill them all again. And he was just about to destroy the ship with all hands. I love that episode for that.
Yeah. Can I derail the conversation right away?
Go ahead.
Well, you may be covering this in the way
not that you one of us.
I know. That's why I went ahead and spoke up. But why is it that this episode gets, for lack of a better term, and for an E rating. Why does it get pooped on by old school Trek fans? Why do you think
it gets dumped on by Trek fans? Really?
Deep Space Nine gets dumped on by Trek fans.
Yeah, just
time.
Just in general.
In recent years, it doesn't happen as much. But when Deep Space Nine, during its run, was the black sheep of Star Trek. People said Voyager was the better show. Voyager had the resources. Rick Berman didn't even pay attention to what was going on in Deep Space Nine. He let Ron Moore and Ira Steven Behr do what they wanted to over here while he was creating the hands down worst series of Star Trek in the prime canon ever made.
Yeah. But this episode in particular was a particular favorite of old guard Trek fans that wanted to point to it and say, this is not Roddenberry's vision.
Maybe because it is so different. It is a completely different story.
Well,
it is.
Everything that comes up to, and this is great because this will lead right into why I chose it. But, I think, and I think Ethan, you'll agree with me, but everything that had come up until this point in the Star Trek universe, whether it was the animated series, which is canon, then isn't canon, then is canon, then sometimes is canon, then sometimes isn't. But everything that came up until this point, the movies, TOS, animated series, Next Generation, even with the exception of For the Uniform, showed that the Federation, humanity, and Starfleet succeeded because even in their darkest hours, they clung to their principles. And no matter how great the threat against them were, clinging to your morality and being a good person was the paramount virtue and the thing of most importance. And you couldn't save the Federation by losing your principles. This episode clearly, for the first time ever, just throws that away. And Sisko bribes Quark. He's working the whole time with an exiled member of the Obsidian Order and a guy who's got thousands of dead bodies laying around all over the place, tortured people for fun in Garrick to get the information. He pardons a criminal, gets Gowron to pardon him, gives away 85 liters of biomimetic gel, which is going to be used for some horrific genetic engineering experiment. He sacrificed every principle he has. And then when it's all said and done, he lies. And when it's all said and done, he's an accessory to murder because the plan all along was to kill the senator and made it look like the Dominion did. You can't find the worst Starfleet officer ever that did that.
Yeah. In his defense, though, he did not understand what he was getting into initially.
No. He didn't know that he was going to go that far.
You could say he could claim that. At least
he could claim that. But I think that's why this is the clearest break. I mean, this is where they just said, screw it. Let's go all in. Let's be the dark Star Trek. Let's be not even gray here. Let's show our hero doing a bad thing and a means justify the end story.
But if you think of
justify ending, the means story, that's what this was.
Yeah. And ending it by saying, if I had to do it all over again, I would do the exact same thing.
I think that's the damning thing about this episode and why people point to it. That's you just hit the nail on the head, Mark.
Yep.
I think that's it. Because ideally, throughout all of Star Trek's run up until this point, Iddick has been the philosophy that it's been teaching us. The needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, right?
And infinite diversity and infinite combinations.
Yeah. Yep. So that's been the principle that's been spelled out. If you're going to look at that and say, well, if you go outside of that, then it's not Star Trek. And okay, Kurtzman Star Trek, yeah, you could probably make that argument for sure. But this one is following Iddick. It's following the IDIC. It is the Federation making a sacrifice of the few in order to benefit the many. And I find it difficult for people to make the argument that this is not Trek somehow.
It depends how you define Trek, and then we're getting into gatekeeping, and I've been guilty of trying to define Trek, but I do think Trek at its, I think we can narrow Trek a little bit and say that Trek has to be an exploration of humanism. You need to be looking at it is at its core a secular humanist vehicle that tries to explain the triumphs and the failings of the human condition, the ups and downs of it, not looking to a higher power, but saying that we can achieve what we're going to achieve because of ourselves and what we can or cannot do and overcome. And this story is still definitely a humanist vehicle that is exploring the human condition just from a different perspective. And it's not one that everybody likes. It's not as bad as Kurtzman Trek. It's not as bad as Picard, where the Federation in time of war abandons every principle it ever has and just about faces on all of it. But you start to see cracks. And I think that's what people didn't like. You had a lot of people who would have said Kirk would have found another way. Picard would have found another way. I don't know if it could have been solved by sleeping with it, so I don't know how Kirk would have found a way through it. Picard would have just made a better speech to Vrenak. But, you know, they would have said these people would have found a better way. And Janeway would have threatened to self-destruct the ship with some Janeway pie. And Archer would have made some weird analogy to a gazelle. But
then, like, you have an example like in City on the Edge of Forever, where Kirk knows what's going to happen, but he makes the decision to allow Edith Keeler to step in front of the truck and die in order to benefit the greater good.
And even hold Bones back.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So, I mean, this In the Pale Moonlight is right in the same tradition of much of the stories that Trek has told over the years.
I honestly think that Star Trek Deep Space Nine was a show that was ahead of its time. And it saw where TV was going, and you had co-showrunners basically in Ira Stephen Bear and Ronald Moore, who, and even Robert Hewitt Wolf was in there for a while in that writing room. Yep. They had no pressure on them. No one cared about Deep Space Nine. It was just out there in syndication. They had a long leash to experiment and do what they wanted to. Which is why they got to serialize, which is why they got to put religion into Star Trek on the fringes. And yes, it's a humanist show, but even in a humanist vehicle, you have to see how human philosophy and humanism interacts with religion when it butts up against it. And they got to run into morally gray characters. They got to kill off a main character unexpectedly in Dax. They got to show you ambiguous characters and you liked them. You came to like Garak and Quark, and you really shouldn't. You know, Quark almost got Dax killed.
Yeah. Garak is absolutely, hands down, one of the most interesting characters in Star Trek. And I had a chance when I got to interview Robert Hewitt Wolf on one of my podcasts to talk with him about his kind of inspiration, because he wrote The Wire, which I think is one of the best Deep Space Nine episodes. And that's dealing with Garak's addiction, right? And you know, he wrote that episode with his sister in mind, because he's very outspoken about how she struggled with addiction issues. And so he wanted to find some way of bringing that to television. And he had the opportunity in his, first or second year of writing on Deep Space Nine. That was one of the episodes that he was able to put forth. And it's just, it's extremely powerful to watch. And knowing where these writers were coming from in that writer's room, they were pushing the envelope, and they were instructed to push the boundaries, and I think they did, but still in an extremely respectful way.
Absolutely. And it's just a fantastic writing room that wasn't afraid to take risks. And that kind of leads me, you know, it leads us right into why I picked this episode as not only one of the best four of Deep Space Nine, but the best episode of Deep Space Nine period, and spoiler, the best episode in my mind of Star Trek period. And one is that it's unique. Ethan, you mentioned it. There's a film noir type of feeling to it, because Sisko is narrating it from his quarters with subdued lighting. And, you know, it's in space. So, you know, you get a dark film, feeling and vibe to that. Okay.
Yeah.
So you start out there. And it's also, it's one of those nice narrations where you know that you're getting the end of the story right now. And they're taking you back in time and running through it. But I also like this because in addition to having a powerful story, the storytelling itself, and we'll get into it more, is actually there on multiple levels. You can see in the conversation with Sisko and the Senator, there's a lot of foreshadowing going on. They slightly foreshadow you to what Garrick's endgame plan is. I love little things in the way that Andrew Robinson gets a massive role in this story, and any story that he gets a big role in as Garrick tends to be, the Garrick-centered stories tend to be some of the best that they do. And I love that you get to see this moral quandary. And again, this is another timeless. Last week's episode was timeless, as long as humans struggle with mortality. As long as humanity struggles with war, so forever, this is going to be a timeless story. Just look at Grant and Sherman in the Civil War. The war was terrible, and they decided that there's nothing you could do to end the war quickest but to take the most brutal measures necessary. The only good action was ending the war as quickly as possible. And Sisko, who's watched friends die, friends of friends, is tired of posting his casualty reports. He says it. When you're dealing with people dying and worlds fighting for their freedom, you don't have time to talk about morality like it's a philosophy class. And the only good action is the action that ends the war quickest with your side winning. Morality becomes real simple in a war. And this episode puts a really fine point on that. That actions that you couldn't live with in peacetime, you can live with pretty easily. Not easily, but you can live with. You can find a way to live with in wartime.
But what happens afterwards?
Well, this is we weren't there yet.
Okay, because at the moment he said he'd do it again, but kick it down the road a little bit.
Oh, I meant the show isn't there yet. Look, I would have loved if Deep Space Nine would have shown you a changed Sisko as a result of this episode. But by the next episode, he's back to normal.
Because one of the things I remember is I thought about this in the movie Gran Torino. And Sickies, if you haven't seen that, go see it. It's a great movie. But in that movie, Clint Eastwood is an older guy. He's a Korean War veteran. And there's a young priest. It's got to be 27. Is trying to talk to him about other guys who are struggling with things they did in war. And how they could come, they did things that they were ordered to do, but that they can come back to peace. And Clint Eastwood says, it's not the stuff that you were ordered to do that bothers you the most. It's the stuff that you did, even though you weren't ordered to do it. That's what haunts a man. And that's what I'm saying. I wonder if that's what's going to happen to Sisko later. Because he wasn't ordered to do this. He volunteered to do it. Now, as you just pointed out, they're not going to get into that, but that would be my whole point of what happens years down the road.
Well, it also brings up the question for me personally was, why is it upon a captain of a, space station to do something like this? Wouldn't you think you would have something else trying to do this? Forgot what the group was called.
Section 31.
Yes, thank you. Wouldn't you think Section 31 would be doing this?
You would definitely think that.
This would be right up their aisle. This would be up their aisle.
And I'm trying to think, we've already been introduced to Section 31, right? They've already tried to recruit Bashir by this point.
Yes, and I'm going to look and see if Intra Armin 7, Wana something, has been aired at this point. Latin words that I don't, in times of war, the law is silent or something is what it translates to.
In Inter Armis Legis. I know.
Yeah. Inter Armis, that's Armin Hammer, that is, baking soda.
That is late season 6 into season 7, I think. And that is where we really start to see what Section 31 is really capable of doing. So I don't think at this point the writers are really leaning too heavily on Section 31, but yes, you're absolutely right, Thomas. That would be
seven.
Yeah, that's what I thought. At this point, they haven't come that far along, which is kind of unfortunate because you're right. This would have been something that Section 31 definitely would have taken on.
And I mean, there's no script. If it has a lot less power if Section 31 does this rather than Sisko. It's a good episode, but it becomes the episode that I just mentioned. If Section 31 does it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I it's another flaw with the Federation, let's say.
Well, I mean, yeah, look, the Federation is a government that has a military space navy masquerading around as an exploration division that pretty much is run by its captains, who can do whatever they want to, because they're like a general in the field back in the Roman times that doesn't have to listen to, can disregard any order coming back from Rome.
Yeah. And you know, that is the great thing about this episode, is it gives us the opportunity to take a top down look at a captain doing something that we never got to see Picard really take on. We certainly didn't get to see Kirk do it. And that is sit in front of the camera and meditate to himself out loud, talk himself through what he's going through, how and why he made the decisions that he made, and then come to terms with the result. And we never got to see that before. And so I even though you can look at it and say Sisko compromised on his principles, you know, he still was the best person in that position making the best possible decisions, I think it could be argued. And this is something that we're seeing throughout the Federation. People are sitting down and making these decisions based on what type of human do they want to be. And you know what? Some of them aren't going to make decisions that are as good as what Sisko does. So yeah, you're going to have some good, and you are going to have some bad in this utopian Federation.
Well, also the question would come up, and I think we should discuss it. Was it a bad decision? Because, I mean, he definitely moved against his moral background, I guess, his own morals, his own ethics.
Yeah, and I think if you argue it from the Roddenberry point of view, then you say, yes, he compromised and he made a bad decision.
Right.
Except, but I think if you're a normal human being, you look at it and say he did the best with what he had to work with.
Not just that, but the question then becomes, he stepped outside of his morals, out of his ethics, but did something that not only saved lives, but you could argue saved the entire Federation, the entire quadrant.
Yeah.
He basically stopped the war. I mean, you could do the same thing as Scott brought up earlier, Civil War. You look at Sherman's March to the Sea. That thing was terrible. But it also brought the war, could be very easily argued, brought the war to a quicker close. Grant's war, you know, fighting was brutal and lost hundreds of lives and thousands of soldiers, but he brought the war to an end.
I think this is another one of these cases where Deep Space Nine lets you draw your own conclusion, whereas Star Trek The Next Generation and TOS would have told you what conclusion to draw. But I think Garrick sums it up very, very, very aptly, where he says, you may have just saved the Alpha Quadrant. This may be the moment that is the turning point of the war. And all it costs was the life of a criminal, the life of a Romulan senator, and the self-respect of one Starfleet officer. I don't know about you, but I'd call that a bargain. And ultimately, I think it is, because the Federation is going under. The Klingon Empire is going under. They're not winning this war. Vrenak paints the picture very clearly. Their shipyards are being reconstructed. The Dominion is flat out. They're in a manpower shortage. They're breeding Jem'Hadar, and they can barely hold the line.
They just lost a major planet at the beginning of this. When right. Beta Zed is
on Earth's back door.
Right. There's a salient. There's a salient right now in the Federation's line, and the Federation is really screwed right now, because not only is Earth in reach, you can't just redirect to defend Earth. You've got Vulcan, Andor, and Earth. And I want to say, they didn't say Teller, did they? It's Vulcan and Andor and Earth are all within striking distance of Beta Zed. You're not just behind the lines.
No, you're those are the major
worlds. You're into the founding worlds. Those are the major
industrial and major cultural and population centers.
Right. You're about to split the Federation in half. It's about to be over. This is Hail Mary time. This is Pickett's Charge time. This is this is Battle of the Bulge. Whatever you've got left, you better throw it.
Oh, this would actually be more like the fall of France.
Yeah.
Almost, because this is, you just went around the Maginot Line.
Right. I mean, this is Stalingrad, where you tell, you know, Fortress Stalingrad. You better figure out something, because Beta Z just fell. You've been getting your tail kicked for the majority of this war. You're on the defensive, and the Klingons, for all that they are, they're not going to hold out on their own against the Dominion and Cardassia. I mean, the Dominion has resources in the Gamma Quadrant. This war never gets taken to the Dominion's territory. When they make a peace, they're not even making a peace because they've lost the war militarily. They make the peace because the Founders are all dying, and Odo's terms is, I'll give you the cure if you make peace. So even when the Federation wins this thing in the end with the Klingons in the alliance with the Romulans, it's not even a win. It's basically like Korea, where they fought it back to the original starting point. But I look at this, and yeah, it's a bargain, because they're going out. And life under Dominion rule is pretty horrible. We've seen throughout this show. I don't want to live under the Dominion. You're cattle to them.
You know the humans under Dominion control. They're going to try and rise up and just get, they're going to get slaughtered.
Yeah, Jem'Hadar are going to come in and just kill everything. And we'd already seen dead to make sure it's dead.
What was it? The quickening? That one whole planet that the Jem'Hadar seeded with that virus and just laid waste to everybody.
Yeah.
So yeah, and this is, that was going to be Earth.
Yeah, and this is a very important point. You're not fighting an enemy who you surrender to and, oh, well. This is an enemy that will exterminate you. You're not really just fighting a war. You're fighting for survival almost at this point.
I know this is going to be a hard thing for Rage Master to accept, because I know his ethics, and he is an ethical. He believes that there is an objective good and an objective morality. I tend to be an ethical relativist, and I believe that the moral decision is subjective depending on the decision that the situation that you find yourself in. I think that what this episode is saying, and I agree with it, is that morality changes depending on the scenario. And wartime morality and peacetime morality are two very different things. And I think Sisko says it very clearly. Here I am debating the finer points of morality while people are dying. And it doesn't give you a lot of comfort to say, I did the moral thing, when you're watching your friends die. And it won't give you comfort to say, I held to my principles, when you're a slave in a Dominion mine or a Cardassian labor camp. Because they're going to let the Cardassians run the whole Alpha Quadrants. Yeah. Just look at Bajor. If you want to know what the Cardassians are going to do to it, they promised it to them. And so I think in this case, as absurd as this sounds, Sisko's actions become the moral actions, and I find myself doing something I can't believe, but I am arguing that an ends justify the means to an extent in this case.
I would agree with you almost 100%. Especially being that I would say that, and again, we talked about this earlier this month, that morals, ethics, and law are three different things. But this is, again, a very key difference, being, I think, especially when at war, your ethics might not change, but the morality of it changes. And my example would be World War II firebombing of Japanese cities and German cities. I mean, that was targeting civilian populations. There's no way of getting around that. But we look at it going, it was total war, civilian casualties, you know, quickened the war. We ended the war that way. Ethically, it's terrible. But morally, you have to look at it and go, yeah, it was necessary in the time period at that time for that reason during that wartime situation. And I think that changes the math in some ways. And I think this episode shows it, that even, you know, Sisko, who he very well holds to his morals and ethics quite often, but he even then steps out at this point and goes, yeah, I did it. I feel bad about it, but I would do it again.
Ragemaster, Ethan, what do you guys think on this?
I'll let Ethan go. I'll let our guest go first.
Well, I think you said it fairly appropriately there, Scott, that if you're looking at it from a humanist point of view, then yeah, it's kind of hard to judge Sisko for what the decisions that he's made here. It's hard to point to him and said, you made the wrong decision, because he did the thing that saved the Alpha Quadrant, that saved billions of individuals potentially. I, from a personal standpoint, as someone that looks to, you know, the word of God, I mean, it becomes a little more difficult to make the argument that he made the right decision. But that's not accepting. I mean, that's looking at it from a real world point of view. Is that loud for anyone else?
Yep.
Yeah.
Hello.
I didn't hear anything.
Yeah, Beck. It sounds like I hear like a machine in the background.
Yeah.
From where?
It's definitely you've come way up, Scott.
Yeah. Is it your heater, Scott?
I mean, that's been on the whole time, so that shouldn't have just all of a sudden. No, you know what? I just moved the phone. I moved the phone. So
that voice is off the scale too.
Okay.
Yeah, that changed.
I just turned it down.
Okay, cool.
Good catch, guys. Yeah, I'm glad you guys heard that, because
I thought that was Ethan for a minute.
No. It just kept getting louder and louder, and I was like, I can't hear myself think. No.
Okay.
Anyway.
Well, it's off now, so go ahead and reset where you were, and I'll just edit it up together.
Okay, I'll start it over then. Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, like what you said earlier, Scott, if you're looking at it strictly from a humanist point of view, then it really becomes difficult to assail Sisko's decision here. He makes the decision that saves potentially billions of humans and other races in the Alpha Quadrant. So, yeah, you can look at that and say, all right, he made the best decision. But then taking a step back and looking at it from like a real world point of view, as a person myself that, you know, tries to do things and hold to a standard that is, you know, in the Bible, for instance, then it starts to become that issue where you can look at the decision that he makes and say, well, he didn't stick to a certain principle. And it's kind of a hard thing to do, to make those arguments from where Star Trek is coming from. Mm. You kind of have to separate the two, I feel like.
Well, I'm going to go. It's something Thomas said that was very interesting just now, and I'm inclined to agree with it. But something related to morals and ethics, how they're different. And they're pretty close, but morals are a lot more of like a guidepost. And ethics are more about your rules and actions. And a moral is a little bit more of you want to be good. It's just an opinion how to be good. Whereas the ethic is the rule to do it. And they are different. And at the end of the day, what do you use when you're in a time of war like that? Do you use your exact code, your ethical code, or do you stick with the moral, that the greater good, the way of defending more life? There was no easy answer for this. And I'm not the one to say this for sure, but I will say this. In life, I mean, I got to be careful how I say this. You know, even for someone who uses, say, the Bible as your guidepost, that's not an assurance that you're not going to make decisions that are going to be unethical or immoral. And not just for the sake of it either. You're sometimes going to have to do that. We would call that a white lie, for example. I mean, it's the same thing as you don't tell someone they're going to die because you know that's going to hurt them. So in essence, you're kind of lying. Or in the case, I mean, war is a great example. Biblically, you're not supposed to kill. But I'll be honest, if some knife wielding maniac came at my wife, I'd have no problems giving them a 45 caliber lobotomy. So you kind of have to, in those cases, you're not going to make the right and godly decision. You're just not, because we are not permitted to judge. We're not death givers or life bringers. So we're going to have to, unfortunately, at that point, use what we got. And in this case, it was Cisco deciding, all right, which one's going to result in more death? Which one results in the greater evil? Well, then I'm going to take the lesser evil. And as you said, Scott, at that point, you can't sit there and debate the finer points.
Yep. And I think
because you're not allowed to say to people, say the loved ones of the lost, well, I'm sorry they had to die. I could have prevented it, but we had some finer points to deal with, and I'm standing by this ethical code, even when it was destroying us. And there are times that you can do that. For example, if you're trying to prevent theft, you know, I could provide for my family, but that would involve me committing great and corrupt evil crimes. Well, that I don't think I could do. If we could get by just fine by me not doing it, then obviously the greater evil is to do the crime. But in this case, it was very clearly the case of if he had not done these things, the universe was going to suffer for it.
Yep.
So he was really caught in a catch 22, and he had to really just go with morals. And that was, which is going to defend the life, which is going to defend the greater amount of life and the greater good. And for that, it meant breaking your ethics. And I suppose going back to something I said what was the one with Gul Dukat?
Duet.
I knew it. The one with Duet, where I said it's also the evil of sitting by and doing nothing. Well, Cisco would have been guilty of that had he not done these things. If he had just sat by and on his dignified high horse said, I cannot because XYZ or ethical principle XYZ, well, you allowed for a greater evil to occur. So there's, ultimately, as much as I hate what he did, I cannot say I'm against what he did, but it's one of those things where I wouldn't have stopped him.
You know,
you can't sit in judgment. So yeah. There you go.
I wasn't going to sit there. I'm not going to stop him and say, you're wrong. You're evil. You're wrong. You're evil. Because if he hadn't done anything, I would have said, you made the wrong move, Cisco. You made the wrong move. Look what happened.
You know, he's still a moral person because
yes,
he's shaking. He's repeating he's saying, I can live with it.
Yes.
He's convincing himself he can live with it.
He's trying to convince himself. And this is, and you would know better. You could tell me on subsequent episodes, this would be something where, being that the character that he is, he's still Star Trek moral and ethical. They don't take away from that. I don't see this episode as some kind of Kurtzman-like deviation, because this is trying to show the aberration of when, well, unfortunately, we still live in a universe of immoral and unethical people, and occasionally we're going to have to tiptoe over that line. Occasionally, in order to support what we have, we're going to have to do this, because Cisco goes back. And the only thing I wish they would have done, shown, and you would have to show this in subsequent episodes, him being shaken by this. I mean, I'm not talking PTSD, just him thinking to himself when he's caught in another sticky situation to say, well, I don't want it to be like that. I don't want to have to do something like that again.
Unfortunately, this is never really brought up again, is it?
not the specific instance, but you do see him at this point. This is where Sisko is going to really start going through his spiritual awakening in the Bajoran religion, essentially. Because I think it's shortly after this one where he has the vision in front of the archaeological pillar that they find. And then that starts him really interacting with the wormhole aliens. And he really takes on that role of the emissary and takes it quite a bit more seriously. Or maybe that's already happened. But in any case,
but he's going through kind of it's still this time where he starts to deepen his role as the emissary.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. So I think... Man, there's things I want to say about this. One of the things, like I said, that the storytelling, we've talked a lot about the ethics and the message in this. And we've, you know, I'm going to circle back to it in the end because I have one more thing to throw out to everybody. But some of the storytelling, I like how this shows that you can accidentally find yourself in further over your head than you intended to. As he said, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And Sisko decides, after seeing a casualty report and somebody says, you know, we need an ally. The Romulans let him through their backyard. He says, that's it. I decided after this casualty report, I was going to bring the Romulans into the war because I'm sick of losing good people. And we're going to get the ally that we need. And then he was wondering, and the fall of Beta Zed convinced him, whatever has to be done, has to be done. And if that means, you know, then you see that the first thing that he realizes he's going to have to do that he doesn't want to do is he's got to get in bed with Garak. And that's distasteful to a Starfleet officer. I mean, I like the character of Elam Garak, and his character is a redemption arc character. But he was a cold-blooded killer and spy and a torturing interrogator for the Obsidian Order. And you kind of see that in the storytelling. Torak, the forger, he is far more terrified of Garak than he was being in a Klingon prison. He's laughing. He's happy. He's cocky. Nothing shaking him. And Garak is here. I'll go wait in my quarters. Sisko physically assaults him. And while he's shaken, it's nothing compared to watching the ice water and terror set in when Garak says, I'll be by to say hello later. Garak is hands down. Garak makes Khan look like a puppy. There's not one person in the Star Trek universe, aside from Q, that I want to be on their bad side less than Elam Garak.
Well, it's amazing that moment where Sisko realizes Garak has played him this whole time. Sisko has played into Garak's hands. Garak has been 8 to 10 chess moves ahead of him since Sisko approached him.
Yep. You just watch.
And that's just, yeah. And it is just beautiful. And you're right. The actor's name, it's blanking.
Andrew Robinson.
Andrew Robinson. Yeah. Just choose the scenery with Garak in those scenes where he's laying it out on the table, why this had to transpire the way it did. And then you talked about you delivered the line earlier where he levels it on Sisko. This is all it cost you. Accept it. Let's move on. You know, and it's just so chilling.
And then you watch. So it starts unraveling. But now the next thing Garak says is, I need this forger who is in a Klingon prison. So I need you to get this criminal to use your favors to get Gowron to let this criminal out who shouldn't be out. And Sisko says, you see him. What's his name? He can still handle this. He doesn't want to do it. He's disgusted with himself, but okay. And then he finds out that the dude tries to kill Quark within a few hours of being on board after trying to assault a Dabo girl. And he goes, crap. And you watch the maturity, the maturation of the relationship between Sisko and Odo. And Odo's like, well, I get it, but I am who I am, and I'm going to have to arrest him if Quark presses charges. And Sisko's like, oh, crap.
Well, and how about the dichotomy between Sisko and Quark? Like in the first couple of seasons of Deep Space Nine, Sisko is smug in holding his humanity and higher moral standard above Quark.
How about the fact that the only reason Quark is there is because Sisko blackmailed him into staying with Nog, not going to a Federation prison?
True.
This is Quark's moment.
Exactly. And what a great moment it is. I absolutely love that season where Quark wraps up the whole discussion with, Thank you for restoring my faith in Witcher.
The 98th rule of acquisition.
Yeah. That everyone has a price.
Yep. And he's like, I think we can call it a bribe. And he's got to get that little twist in that it was a bribe.
Yeah. Well, there's also the thing of having it with Odo. Remember, Odo earlier wants to arrest everyone for every little thing. And Sisko's always on going, no, you can't do that because of, you know, the law. At this point, Sisko's the one going to Odo going, can you just not look the other way?
And then it gets worse. So, like, and now this is just little things, man. He didn't kill anybody. He's just wanted for the Klingon Empire for, you know, basically selling knockoff Air Jordans. But, then Odo, you know, he's got to accept that he bribed Quark. And that these are all just things to his honor and things to his pride. Now it's going to get worse. Because the guy who's going to provide the data rod only wants to be paid in biomimetic gel. And I just want to say that Dr. Phlox has none of the hangups on using this stuff that Julian Bashir does. Dr. Phlox would have been like 200 liters. I used that yesterday just to make the animals to feed all my pets in sickbay. Here you go. I have some good uses for this thing. Here's my bulk.
I don't know about that. I don't know about that because Phlox was a moral guy. Phlox would have thought. Well, he would have at least inquired, why do you need it? And if you don't give me a good reason, you're not getting it.
Possibly. He played fast and loose creating Sim and was right ready to kill him at the end and withhold the knowledge that there are potential treatments to extend his entire life so he didn't have to die quickly. Phlox is pretty bad in similitude, man.
I just don't see Phlox letting something like that be handed out to a criminal.
Probably not.
He didn't know who it was going to, but this is also a good question.
Okay, are we talking regular Phlox or are we talking mirror Phlox? Because if it's mirror Phlox, he'll straight up murder whoever gets this.
Yes. Mirror Phlox would think it's funny and go, as long as I can have some of the research.
Mirror Phlox. Hey, what's in that IV, Doc? Acid. Too late.
actually, it would probably not be acid. It would be a neurotoxin that causes extreme pain.
Yeah.
Acid might kill.
Right. Right. But so now, like, Sisko, you know, now he gives Bashir the orders in writing, and now he knows he's lost, a little bit of the self-respect to Bashir because he's done something that he would never do. He puts one of his officers in a position where he's going to make them do something they don't want to do. But at least he gives them the cover of the written order. And it just keeps deteriorating. And then we get into, I said there's foreshadowing. If you watch, the first time you watch Sisko and Vrenak meet, the commentary on the Romulan ale being a very good approximation, and he finds himself, says, I'm warming to the odor of it, and you almost forget that it's an approximation. Just seems like normal small talk, you know? When you watch the episode the second time, and you know what's coming, and that it definitely, he is going to see that it's a fake, it means a lot more. They're foreshadowing it right there. There's a guy that can sniff out a fake instantly. I thought that was a beautiful piece of storytelling.
It is, because that's Vrenak indicating to Sisko, I don't trust anything you have to say. It doesn't matter what we talk about, I'm not going to believe it. And you know he goes back to his ship, and it probably does not take long for him to sniff out the fake.
Yep. And then you see the exchange where Garak says, I'm going to, while you're meeting with Vrenak, I'm going to be on his ship. There's no need for Garak to tell Sisko this. It doesn't need to be in the plan in any way, shape, or form. And you know Garak doesn't need Sisko's approval to go do it. He's already figured out his way to do it. It's foolproof. The only reason they're telling you that Garak is going on that ship is so that if you're, it's a tip off to the audience that this isn't going to work and Garak is placing his backup plan right now. But the other thing I love is the little barb he takes at Worf as he walks by, and you see Worf like snarl like he just threw open his mouth because he saw Garak.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because those two don't like each other. And, But it's masterful. And I just love Garrick's, like, he'll have no more than four bodyguards. Two of them will stand guard here, and two of them will not leave the docking bay. Yeah, Garrick's done his homework.
Yeah. As in, maybe he knows exactly how many guards are coming and exactly what route he's doing, and maybe even has the codes to get in, onto the ship.
It also makes me wonder.
He always knows more than he lets on.
It also makes me wonder if Garrick got two data rods, because he says they'll find one that miraculously survived the explosion, as if when he was on board that ship, he made sure to place the second rod in a place where it would have to be found.
Hmm. Well, yeah.
I hadn't thought of that.
But, you know, that's just me
knowing him, that's possible. Well, it's very possible knowing Garrick.
And that maybe he planted the fake one just so he could enact the other plan.
One of the other things I love in the, you know, talked about the acting. Sisko is at his very best in this episode. And this is an episode where me saying Sisko punches somebody definitely is part of the Deep Space Nine formula. But this episode is carried and made even better by the superb, almost limitless skills of Andrew Robinson as Garrick. Just playing the creepy, subdued, low-key assassin spy. And Sisko being the outraged, full of emotion, straight-ahead, bull-in-a-china-closet person that he is. But what I love is, throughout this entire episode, Garrick gets the better. It, you know, as you said, Ethan, he's 10 moves ahead every time. But Garrick always gets the better of Sisko. Sisko comes in blazing full speed ahead like he does and runs over his subordinates as the captain. And Garrick disarms it every time without ever raising his voice, without ever getting excited, until he's getting punched in the face. But even then, it's a measured response. You know, when Sisko says, when they're talking about the biomimetic jelly, he says, offer him something else in that, you know, leadership authority tone that says the discussion's closed. Mm-hmm. And Garrick just comes back with that, believe me, if I thought he would accept something else, I wouldn't be asking. And just opens the door up again, just firmly, you know, saying, you try to close it, I'm still right here, Captain. And throughout this entire show, it's a dichotomy of Garrick's subdued, reserved manipulation. It's like a power puncher in Mike Tyson versus a counter puncher in Floyd Mayweather if they were in the right weight class.
Scott, I'm going to interject something right now, if I may. This story, you've mentioned how good the story is. This story was by Peter Allen Fields, was the writer for this story. Coincidentally, he also had a hand in Duet as he did the teleplay for that episode, which I think is very interesting. You're making that point of the counter between Sisko and Garrick, because we almost see a little bit of that Duet playing out a little bit in this story as well. I just think Peter Allen Fields is a great writer, and I wanted to bring that up right now.
Nice.
And we did talk about the story. They did take that. The name of the title of the episode does come from the Batman film.
Okay.
Now, really?
I do have a question for all of you. Do you think that Garrick was already planning this before Sisko approached him?
Oh, boy.
I don't.
I think Sisko makes the decision. But then once Garrick gets wind of it, he knows exactly how it's going to play out.
Well, I'm only wondering because I have a feeling how Garrick always acts is I think he might not be actively planning something or setting things up, but I think he always plans for things. Always has. If this happens, I know this guy over here and this contact over there, and this is what I can do.
Well, I mean, these are things he already had on hand, so I don't think it's necessarily he planned it ahead of time. I wouldn't be surprised if he were ready for this kind of an eventuality.
Whatever he was planning ahead of time, his first plan failed because he said it'll take every contact I have on Cardassia, and he tells them they're all dead. Every one of them within a day of talking to me, they're all dead. So I think whatever plan he was going for at the beginning, this is him freewheeling. So he might have went into his bag of contacts and contingency plans, but he definitely had to freewheel this one together because whatever his first plan was, this wasn't it. We didn't do rips and picks, but does anyone have any rips?
I have a rip.
Oh, let's hear it.
Can we talk about beds in the 24th century?
Oh
my God. Deep Space Nine. I would not want to stay on Deep Space Nine overnight. I mean, and this was a great episode. It shows Sisko laying in bed. He's woken up in the middle of the night. And I'm like, that just, he looks like he's sleeping on a examination table. And it's just, it's terrible. And every time you see a bed and those little triangle pillows they use, and I'm just like, no, this is not how humans sleep in the 24th century.
Unless they made a lot of really more comfortable padding that's only an eighth of an inch thick, like transparent aluminum, but, you know, not transparent aluminum, just some wonder material.
Well, even then, let's be honest, this is supposed to be the future, and you'd think, I don't know, you'd have some kind of improvements. You're absolutely right when you're looking at that. I thank you for bringing that, because I didn't even think about that, but now you bring it up, it's like, yeah, that's, wow.
I mean, for Pete's sake, they have maglev technology. You know, you push a cart over the ground. You don't have wheels touching the ground. Why can't you just sleep in midair, suspended in midair? That's got to be more comfortable than their beds that they have there.
Maybe safety issues. But I'm just saying there might be a safety issue, power outage or something, fall, break your back. But I'm saying you don't think, let's be honest, you're making spaceships. And you have warp technology and grav tech. You don't think you have some kind of new, I don't know, more comfortable padding that doesn't look like the most uncomfortable thing on the planet?
Yeah. I have a theory that Worf is more human than the humans. He couldn't stand the beds, and so he moved to the Defiant to have more comfortable bedding. I think that's why he moved out there.
Is that it?
That is a good theory. Let's be honest. I've heard weirder Star Trek theories, so
yeah,
I wouldn't put that past him. But yeah, I'm really trying to think if I have another rip.
I can't think of well, we have the rip now with the bed. I can't think of one. But it is. It's not a rip. It just seemed funky the way he was talking to the camera and breaking the fourth wall. But as when you pointed out how noir that was, I kind of really respected it then. So that eliminated my rip.
I think it's odd. I agree with you. It's odd. And he's breaking the fourth wall, but the way that he's breaking it is definitely noir, but it's also, it's very much this way of when he's talking, he is talking to a recording. He's making this recording of stuff. So it doesn't seem as jarring of a break. I mean, it's definitely a break of a fourth wall, but it's not as jarring of a break that you would think it would be. Doing something that you would think would jar you out of it doesn't.
You know, now that you're closer, there is one rip. So he records it and then says, computer erase. So there's no way to retrieve that afterwards?
You know, I'm going to stop you right there, Mark, and interject. I have two conclusions to Star Trek episodes that I feel like are the greatest in history. And one of them is the end of Best of Both Worlds, part one, when Riker says fire and you get the bombastic music to close out the cliffhanger, right? That's one of that is probably the best ending in Star Trek, any episode.
Okay.
This one I put as a very close second. I love the way this episode ends. I mean, when Sisko looks at it and says, computer, delete that entire entry, and it just goes black.
Yeah.
I mean, that is, it's a moment that raises the hackles on my neck.
It was amazing, but it also just made me think, so there's no way to retrieve that information?
Well, I'm sure O'Brien probably could.
In the 24th century, captains have a very good erasal program that will absolutely scramble everything beyond retrieval, but only captains.
After it filters through the Section 31 database first.
Correct.
But I don't think Section 31 would be so upset with his decision, so they just let it go.
Right, right.
Yeah. Well, you do also have the question that, again, this is Star Trek, so whatever you need the story to happen will happen.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
The computer somehow will magically be magical when you need it to be and delete whatever you need it to delete when you need it to.
Sure.
So in this case, it's the same way as people suddenly being able to hack stuff in movies by just touching a couple things on a keyboard and like, I'm in.
Just really? Remember, on no less than three separate occasions, or maybe four, Star Trek has used the transporter or one of Bones' serum as a real fountain of youth.
Yes, that is true.
Well,
so one ever has to die in the Star Trek world again. You can just jump in the transporter. Hell, Picard was dead. Picard beamed his energy into space in season one and then had his energy float back into the computer and then got reintegrated with an old Picard pattern into his body and just lost memories.
We were just talking about finding rips, and I was just scraping the barrel there. I was making a reach, okay?
I have one, and it's a big rip.
I respect your rip, Mark. And don't think that I don't respect it. But we live in cancel culture today, and I'm canceling your argument.
It's a good rip. It's a real good rip.
All righty, then.
I'll let the delete go because, one, Sisko isn't concerned about it because he had Starfleet signed off on all of it. Starfleet signed off on it. So he's covered. He said that earlier. Whatever went wrong, he was covered. And
mention if the Romulans ever found out, who cares? They're already at war.
Correct. And the Romulans aren't going to get those records. Starfleet would have to turn them over to the Romulans, but not going to happen.
Right.
But I think it's also symbolic of what Sisko is going to have to do to move on and live with it. You get Sisko's answer of how he can live with it. He's going to forget it ever happened and move on as if it didn't ever happen. But I have one rip, and it's not a rip of this episode directly. I'm going to indirectly rip Voyager with this episode. You're going to see next year is going to be fun. But
oh, boy.
If this was a Voyager episode, we would have heard a 48-minute soliloquy from Janeway as to why she committed no immoral action and her killing three times as many people, setting out to do so from the start, was the greatest moral action anyone had ever taken.
Okay.
See, I'm not a fan of Janeway.
Well, there's your preview for next year.
Oh, trust me, we're looking forward to next year.
I don't know if I can find...
Then we'll call it Least of the Worst.
Yeah, it might have to be. No, there's four good episodes of Voyager. I just don't know if there's going to be a supplemental of the ones that just missed.
Okay.
Well, let's be honest. You used to say that this wasn't your favorite either.
Yeah.
Things grow on you.
Yeah, no, but Voyager has kind of been like... It's like a dirty diaper. You smell it... And then it just keeps getting stronger and stronger and stronger and worse. And that's once you smell Voyager, it just gets worse.
Actually, it's the other way around, but we'll just go with your bad example.
Whatever. Okay. So I mentioned earlier that I had something I wanted to circle back to when we were discussing about Sisko's decision and is it moral and how Picard or Kirk would have found a third way. And it got me thinking throughout the episode, was Picard ever in a similar situation? And boy, oh boy, was he in a similar situation. Season 5, I, Borg. He finds wounded Hugh. And his first plan is to send Hugh back as a time bomb that will destroy the entire Borg collective within months. And total systems failure.
And he doesn't do it.
And they are at war with an implacable enemy. Even Deanna Troi says we're at war. It's justified. And Guinan, of all people, gets to Picard. And Picard's decision in this moment is not to take the immoral action that would have tainted his morality and his self-respect. And he gets read the riot act by Admiral Macheyev over it in season 7. And the Borg go on to kill and assimilate trillions of sentient life across the galaxy. If this would have worked, There can be no arguing that the galaxy would have been a better place. I mean, Species 8472 would have never came looking for us. The Borg went looking for them. The galaxy would have been an infinitely better place had Picard taken that action. And many of the individual Borg living probably would have said that they would be infinitely better off freed from their hell had he taken that action.
Well, he says it himself in First Contact when he says, if you see any of your former colleagues, kill them. Believe me, you'll be doing them a favor.
Yep.
Scott, I think you just answered the ultimate question. Is Sisko the better captain? And I think you've argued that Sisko is.
Well, and based on what I was saying earlier, Picard took the greater of two evils in that he took a decision that, sure, the Borg were going to not be mass executed, but then again, by his own admission later on, wouldn't that have been a mercy killing? Because people who are assimilated, they're not themselves anymore.
No.
You can't sit here and say, oh, they're just, it's not like a cult follower where they've just been brainwashed. No, they're literally not themselves anymore.
Yeah, they've been changed. And, you know, so we come back to it. Picard made the moral decision. How good does he feel about that decision? Does his morals make him feel warm and fuzzy against the trillions of dead and assimilated that resulted from that decision?
I would say he made an ethical decision. Whether he made a moral one is...
Picard followed his principles. Picard did what the enlightened Roddenberry human is supposed to do and make the good guy decision to not take life. Even life that's different from we understand it, even the life of our avowed enemy who wouldn't hesitate to take ours. Is it the right decision? Or is that the biggest failing of Jean-Luc Picard's leadership ever until he just quits Starfleet and goes back to his vineyard?
Well, this again brings up the very good question of morals, ethics, and again, the humanist arguments.
Well, he was clearly taking the higher moral road, quote unquote higher.
Correct. But it's also, this is again why I'm saying the humanist look at it. Well, when you have to sometimes take your morals and your high ground and your beautiful utopia and take a step back and say, what actually is best, what might be bad for me in the moment or bad for me in the long term, will that actually be better overall?
Yeah.
I think we also see why Sisko's leading the war for the survival of the Federation on the front lines, and Captain Picard, as he says in Insurrection, is ferrying people back and forth to diplomatic functions. Pretty obvious who I want leading the war front, given those two decisions there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Good point.
One captain is much more of a military leader.
The other one is a diplomat.
Sure.
Look, I like Captain Picard. He's still my favorite captain. I love, as I said, I put the defector in simply because of how he owns Tomalak at the end with Do We Die Here Together Today? I feel very good about surviving an individual battle with Jean-Luc Picard as my captain. I don't know about a war. I don't know if I want him as my war leader.
You're absolutely right, because again, those two, a diplomat and a military leader, takes totally different requirements.
Or a guy to win a battle. Winning a battle is one thing. You know, it's like, look, if I got to win a battle, give me Robert E. Lee. If I got to win a war, give me U.S. Grant.
Yeah, you're right. And what's the saying? You know, you've won the battle, but not the war.
Exactly.
And it's a difference. Being a tactical battlefield commander and being a theater commander are very different things. And just because you're great at one, you can be the best theater commander in the world and a terrible battlefield commander, and vice versa.
A great example. Here we go. Patton. I would take Patton every day on a battlefield to win that battlefield battle. But I wouldn't push him any higher than that. He was terrible any higher.
And you want Eisenhower.
Eisenhower, and then Eisenhower was a great theater commander, but I don't even think Eisenhower could have done what Marshall did when he managed to somehow rebuild the U.S. military from nothing and get it to fight two front war and win.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't have switched those around. I would not have taken Marshall and put him into Patrick, you know, position and had him lead the armor. It would have been a disaster.
Right.
Each command had a different strength and different qualities needed in that position. And this is the thing where Sisko is a military leader, even from the beginning. He's put on the frontier as far away from you as the core worlds as you really can get, facing a possible war pretty much all the time and having to fight. And this shows it perfectly who he is, what he does, and what kind of commander he is. Now, for me, it cements him as one of the best, if not the best, captain.
Yeah, I can't disagree. And, you know, we come full circle to the discussion, you know, where Ethan started us 4 minutes in. Why did people crap on this episode, and why during its original run did people have problems with Deep Space Nine? Compare season 5, Next Generation, iBorg, and then this episode, which comes out 7 years later, and look at where the two franchises have gone. It would have been inconceivable to have Picard make any other choice than he did. While you were watching iBorg, you knew they were not going to send Hugh back as a time bomb to kill the Borg. And you got to the point that in 7 years later, they remade this franchise to the point that you knew the path that Sisko was going to take. It would be inconceivable to do anything else than what Picard did 7 years ago. And there were a lot of Star Trek fans that it was too much, too quick, and too much of a deviation from what they were expecting. And that's why, like a fine wine, Deep Space Nine has gotten older and more appreciated by the base as the series has aged. It's aged better than any of the series out there, period. In my opinion. I have spoken. Does anyone want to add anything before we rate it and then let Ethan run through his just mists or his top 10?
No, I have nothing.
Think we hit pretty much everything.
How many data rods out of 10 do we want to give it? Like we need to ask. But let's go.
Okay, I'm going to start here. And I have so far been very careful with my ratings and have gone 9.8, 9.5. This one, I'm giving a full out flat 10. I see why you picked this as your favorite, and I get it. I understand, and I get what it's saying. I get the conversation it's trying to spark, and it does the entire story beautifully. And for me, this one gets a 10.
I think for everything we mentioned that makes it a 10, it's got all the key science fiction elements. The whole purpose of science fiction, it does explore the human condition. It does explore morality. It explores it in so much as that what happens when we occasionally have to tiptoe out of the line? What do we do? What's the right course of action? And that is essentially a main, even though it's not heavy on the science part, it doesn't need to be it. Some parts of science fiction are going to be heavy on the science or exploration, and others are going to be heavy on the humanity and the human condition or the condition of life. And that's what this episode does. You know, when you have an episodic show like this is, you can have those episodes of just science and then it's episodes of war or morality or the human condition. And that's what this is. And because it does it so well, it tries to become more grounded and realistic while not surrendering the Star Trek ideal. It doesn't go full Kurtzman and decide everybody's a jerk, but everybody's a jerk except for these people, and try to just crap all over what Star Trek stands for. It just tries to show that, well, unfortunately, we're going to have to occasionally do the lesser of two evils. And this is how we do it Star Trek style. Soap 10.
Ethan, I'll let you go, or I'll let you finish.
Yeah. Okay.
It's, you know, anyone wonder what I was going to do? It's 10 out of 10. One, you can't have a war arc that's believable without having people's morals get compromised. So it gets a lot of points for bringing believability to a war arc. Two, it's a complete exploration of the human condition, and it does that in a compelling way because it says what happens when you're forced to choose between your principles and survival, and what will you do in that moment? And this isn't Walking Dead-esque, but it's on that line where you're choosing to do things that violate your core principles because it's necessary, and it's going to change you, it's going to scar you, it's going to hurt you. But you also find out that you can live with that choice because it served a greater good. Sisko isn't a bad guy here because he's not being bad to be bad. He's being bad to serve a greater good. He's violating principle to serve a greater good. And it's a utilitarian ethics. It's accounting ethics. But beyond this exploration and watching Sisko be tortured and watching Sisko lose his principles bit by bit until there's no way out, and then finally seeing how thoroughly outplayed he was by Garrick and how much deeper into this bloody mess than he thought he was. You watch that erosion of those principles, and you watch Sisko lose a part of his soul bit by bit, and the cost that's going to come to protect Utopia. Freedom isn't free. Utopia isn't free. It doesn't just cost vigilance. It sometimes takes a piece of a person's humanity and a piece of a person's self-image and who they are, their soul, that can never be gotten completely back, to have that. And so every single day in this great country of America where we do live free, be thankful of the people who are no longer with us, who sacrificed a part of themselves to give us that, and the people who are today out there sacrificing parts of themselves every single day to allow us to not have to, and to stand on our principles and make long-winded speeches about morality and good and holding to your principles in times of trouble. It's the guys who mostly do and find a way to walk that line, protect us, keep us safe, and mostly hold to their principles, whether that's in the military, whether that's our government leaders, whether that is our intelligence agencies, or whether that's our police and rescue, who find a way to keep us safe. It's not free. It has a cost, and it's a horrible cost for some, so that the rest of us can sleep easy and comfortably cling to our own morality and principle. Beyond that, it is a fantastically acted episode. You're never going to find a better acted episode in Star Trek all around. You may find ones that are as good, but you won't find a better one. You won't find a better written episode, I don't think. And I don't think you're going to find a better shot and directed episode than this. Fantastic. It's as good as it gets. And as long as I watch Star Trek, I don't know if I'll ever find one better.
Scott, you mentioned you were briefly trying to compare this, like, it's not Walking Dead-ish. And that's a good thing, because as I've always pointed out, one of the biggest problems of Walking Dead is that it really does look like some days that they just sat down and said, what disgusting human atrocity have we not done yet? Let's just make sure we do that. Let's just make sure someone's eating a baby. Where this was trying to say, can we actually have a discussion without divulging into what's the most disgusting thing we can think of?
Got to stop watching The Walking Dead after season 5.
Well, thank you, Scott, for putting me in the awkward position of putting an underwhelming exclamation mark on this.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Scott. You need to learn how to do this.
I tried to give him the position of honor.
I heartily agree with what you guys are, all of the points that y'all have brought out. This is an exquisite episode of Star Trek and the best of Deep Space Nine, without a doubt. And so, yeah, I give it a 10 out of 10, the same as you. Just to reiterate the point, I love the fact that we have Sisko facing this moral dilemma and being able to recognize some of ourselves in that captain. Because regardless of where our moral compass is, there are those times when we're put into those positions where we may not like the decision that we are forced into making. And that's what's happened to him here. So we can kind of recognize that, and I appreciated it. This is also an example of not needing intense action and action for action's sake in order to make a fantastic episode of Star Trek or science fiction in general. And that's something that New Trek hasn't quite figured out yet. So yeah, just to reiterate, this is a 10 out of 10. This is a must watch if you're a Star Trek fan.
Boy, this is another bottle show, isn't it? It's another bottle show.
It is.
And I mean, Deep Space Nine really knew how to do their bottle shows.
Yeah.
So, usually we'd go into some other stuff here, but Ethan, let's go through, I don't know how many episodes you have here, but let's run through your list of the best episodes of Deep Space Nine.
Okay. Yeah. I just want to bring off first thing, Way of the Warrior, you guys talked that one. And I just, as a listener, I just wanted to compliment y'all on your discussion of that episode. That is not one I would have put on my list, just to, you know, full disclosure. But after hearing your discussion of it, I have a greater appreciation for Way of the Warrior now, and I did not have that before. So just props to you guys for a very well put together discussion of that particular episode, because I did not see that one coming. The ones that I would say should have been on the list, Past Tense. That is a brilliant two-part episode that really shines a light on how humans treat the ills of society. And I think that's definitely one. Maybe it doesn't make everybody's list, but I definitely think that should be one to be considered. That's where Sisko and Bashir and Dax get transported back in time to like the 2040s, and they're put into basically a ghetto where the downtrodden, the mentally unstable criminals, all of them are thrown into this ward basically together, and that is how society has chosen to deal with the undesirables. And it's definitely an indictment on how we think and feel and view people in those positions in society today. So I think that's one that definitely needs to be considered. Paradise Lost. I brought that. That's the second half of the two part story arc. What was the first one? Homefront.
Yeah. Yep.
But Paradise Lost really puts the exclamation mark on all that can be lost in the face of fear. And I think that's a great episode for having that particular discussion. Impact Nor from the end of the fifth season is a superb example of Deep Space Nine allowing its secondary characters to be featured and to grow and to develop and carry the show forward. It does this thing that we loved seeing in Mirror Mirror on original series. And does it even better than Deep Space Nine's Mirror Universe episodes, in my opinion. It takes the sets and the characters that we're familiar with, and then it just completely turns it all on its head. And it's spooky, it's intense, it's comical in places. It's just extremely well done. And yeah, I absolutely love that episode and it's probably fringe, but it's my pick, and I would have thrown it on the list had I been asked. And then I just wanted to bring out, you can't isolate a single episode, but I think that six episode arc that starts out season six, starting with A Time to Stand and ending with Sacrifice of Angels, that is epic and should be at the top of anyone's watch list if they're going to delve into Deep Space Nine at all. And then finally, one that very recently has kind of been brought to the forefront, and it's one that you cannot ignore, and that is Far Beyond the Stars. It deals with race in a very touching way, and it is probably Avery Brooks' best portrayal on screen, on television, certainly with Deep Space Nine.
I love Far Beyond the Stars, and you know, for a long time, you know, it leaves you kind of like with Buffy the Vampire Slayer season six, where is she in a mental institution, or is she actually, you know, is it a demon making her think she is trying to trap her there? And she, you know, and it kind of, they flash back and they show her sitting in the ward. For a minute, if you watch Far Beyond the Stars, you don't know. Is Deep Space Nine the delusion and the dream of a writer in the 40s that went crazy? Or is it the prophets making him think, you know, and seeing it from a different perspective and him trying to be trapped by the Pa Wraith, I believe, right?
Yes.
And ultimately, you realize that this is a deception by the Pa Wraith. And Sisko has to fight through it. And you get back to that at the beginning of season 7, too. What is it? Visions in the Sand or something?
Yeah, I'd have to look it up. Nature.
Yeah. I'm not as good on my Deep Space Nine titles as I am on my next gen titles. But yeah, no, I mean, Far Beyond the Stars is a fantastic, wonderful episode that lets all the actors play a different role, too. And it's nice to see. You even get General Martog in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those are, I can't disagree with any of those choices if you're rounding out a top 10 list. I would have put The Die Is Cast, that two-parter there. And I might have put, I don't want to say A Man Alone. It's the one where you find out that in the past, Odo executed 4 Bajorans without fully looking into it.
Yes, that is a great one as well.
I think I would have put that on that top 10 list as well with it. But
Image in the Sand, that's the season 7 first episode.
You beat me to figuring it out there.
You mentioned it, and to bring it up again, The Siege of AR-558, that is a fantastic war episode.
I think a lot of times, I don't know why, but when I think of the war episode, I think it gets lost with me behind In the Pale Moonlight, and it takes away some of its power. And then the companion to In the Pale Moonlight, The Siege of AR 557 is, or 558, whatever. It's Only a Paper Moon Anyway. Deals with Nog's post-traumatic stress syndrome of losing the leg. And it's a real excellent look at that. But at some point next week, I'm going to do the supplemental I usually do to show you my near misses and honorable mentions. And it's going to look a lot like Ethan's list. So,
well, I'm happy you guys let me speak my mind on a few of these, because these were the ones that were near and dear to my heart. And I'm looking forward to your breakdown. And it's great to talk Deep Space Nine. I have really appreciated you guys having me on for this month, for sure.
You know, Ethan, it's not as prestigious of an award as being the fifth Ramon or the fifth Beatle, but I can't give away Corey's spot as the fourth member of Sci-Fi Malady, but you are, you know, the unofficial fifth member of Sci-Fi Malady. And as I said, it's an open chair and an open invite whenever you want to pop in and talk some science fiction with us.
So can I take the mantle of Sci-Fi Malady contributing listener?
Absolutely.
Sure. All right, I'll take that mantle.
Awesome. We could also call you the regular, the irregular regular.
Sure. Either one of those works for me.
Absolutely. It's a blast having you, and it's nice to talk to other people who are has the same enthusiasm about Star Trek and also sci-fi.
Whatever else.
So, Rage Master, what's on tap for next month?
Next month is going to be Love in Space Month. Stay tuned for that.
Ah, we're getting sappy. This is amazing, because most of you should know this by now. Mark hates every love story in a movie.
No, he doesn't. So he's like,
why is
he
this love story in here?
No, I don't. I hate when a love story has nothing to do with anything, and suddenly it just jams on the brakes so I could get delved into the relationship, which has very little to no bearing on the actual story or the point. It's like making a thesis to a paper called I don't know. Let me just make up a thesis here that the United States Civil War was inevitable. There's your thesis. And in the middle of it, you decide to jam on the brakes and talks about, well, let's go talk about labor relations in Ohio. Wait, what?
Hey, listen, let me give you guys Rage Master's review of Romeo and Juliet. It's an amazing play, except for the love story. The love story ruined it.
You just are not listening, Scott. Clean out your ears for a minute and stop thinking like Scott. That's okay, because the love story is the core thesis, the point of the story. I hate it when it's like, well, we got this story, but that's about, you know, take the story we just reviewed. And imagine that interspersed within it, we had to have a relationship story about Ben and his girlfriend. That's what I hate. Because at the end of the day, why is that there? Why does it matter? It doesn't matter. It's just there because you think it's going to make a girl watch this. It ain't going to work.
No, Romeo and Juliet has nothing to do with love. It has to do about two families fighting each other. So love has nothing to do with it. You should absolutely hate.
But the point of tragedy is that these two lovers cannot overcome that. It's all interwoven. But if you just introduce Ben Sisko's girlfriend, because we have to have a love angle, it doesn't have a bearing. If you are able to remove the love story and the story moves normally or better, it's useless.
Well, right. In that case, let's find out what love stories are in space.
We'll find that out next month. But to summarize, Rage Master hates love stories in love. If you have comments on this episode or anything else, you can leave them on our website at
broad sweeping statements.
RavingLunaticMedia.com. 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 Also located at Rage Master hates love stories in sex jacuzzi. Wait, no, I'm sorry. No, don't go to that website. What's left? Wait, no, I can't get out of here yet. Ethan, plug your podcast, plug your websites, plug your Twitter.
Alrighty. Ageofgeek.podbean.com. That's where you'll find everything Age of Geek. We have geek discussions there. This year is the year of the kaiju. We are talking about Godzilla movies from the Toho Studios Showa era from 1954 to 1973. That is the project.
The good ones.
The good ones. But that is also... Yes.
I'm going to need you in May, okay?
Okay. I will be happy to spot on that. But yeah, my son and a couple of other friends, we're going to be rotating through those movies. And it's going to be a great discussion all year as we see King Kong versus Godzilla coming out in cinemas this year. So that's the project there. You can also find Drive Back the Night on Podbean as well. That is AndromedaSeries.podbean.com. That's where we discuss Gene Roddenberry's Andromeda, episodic discussions over there with Ryan Mazzocco. You can find us on Twitter. Geek_age is the geek or Age of Geek Twitter. And then you can also find Andromeda Pod on the Twitter as well. And you can interact with us there. We love hearing from people that listen.
Awesome. Go listen to Ethan. What's left for them to do, Rage Master?
Stay sick, sickies.
No, hate love stories.